This is KJZZ, your news and information station in Phoenix and across Arizona. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. It's the podcast designed to catch you up on some highlights from around the region. Thanks for listening. Here are a few of the stories for the week of September 30th, 2024. State legislatures don't get as much attention during elections as the races for president and Congress, but they might have more impact on your daily life. A change in who runs the Arizona legislature could affect the future of the state's school voucher program that Republicans expanded in 2022. From the Politics Desk, Wayne Shutsky reports.
Republicans took the state's small school voucher program and made it one of the most expansive in the country, letting any family use tax dollars to pay for private school tuition or homeschooling. For parent Chelsea Ellison, that's been a success after her daughter struggled in public elementary schools.
It took us a little bit of last year to get her where she should have been in general, and now she's thriving. She loves school.
Ellison's children are among the 77,000 enrolled in the program, up from 12,000 kids before the expansion. Voucher parents like Ellison, who talks to me at her home while her kids took an art class, say they've been paying taxes, but experienced a deteriorating situation in public schools.
There was larger class sizes, more budget cuts. We had no STEM teacher, we had no music teacher, we had no art teacher.
But the vouchers, about $7,000 per child in most cases, worry parents with kids still in public schools, like Miriam Hoban, who I met at a Scottsdale Unified school board meeting.
I feel like the vouchers definitely take away from the critical dollars that the public schools need to keep providing the excellent schooling that they are capable of providing.
Arizona's voucher program expansion became a model for Republican-controlled states like Iowa and North Carolina. But last year, it cost $718 million in Arizona that critics say came at the expense of public schools and contributed to a budget deficit requiring cuts elsewhere as well. Meanwhile, Hoban, the public school mom, says teachers or parents are forced to pay out of pocket for basic necessities like pencils and markers.
I notice that the amount of resources available to the teachers directly, it's just not there. Any kind of funding for improvements at the school is not there.
Democrats hope to flip a few Republican seats and have a Democratic-run legislature to work with Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs, who took office shortly after Republicans passed the voucher expansion. Soon after she took office in 2023, she put the voucher program back on the agenda.
The previous legislature passed a massive expansion of school vouchers that lacks accountability and will likely bankrupt this state.
How families spent that money has generated headlines focused on questionable expenses, like private lessons in luxury cars and ski resort passes, supposedly part of their child's education. And, critics say, a disproportionate number of vouchers are subsidizing private school tuition for families that were already paying for it without assistance. Ellison, the voucher mom, said she understood that frustration, but pointed out that those families pay taxes too.
But when it gets down to, like, comparing pears and peaches and apples and oranges, we can get pretty ugly towards one another. But the truth is, most of us pay taxes.
For Democrats to win enough seats to take control of the legislature, they might have to temper their goals for scaling back the program, says pollster Paul Bentz.
I don't expect that they could mount a full-fledged repeal. I think that would be challenging for some of the swing areas for Democrats. But I certainly think, at a minimum, there would be regulation on it and probably some definite changes to the program.
But Bentz says Arizona's swing districts have plenty of parents like Ellison, who says she prefers to keep her kids learning at home.
I've watched them learn more and want to be part of learning since. Before, it was fighting to do homework.
She supports putting additional guardrails on the program, but doesn't want to upend the progress her kids have made at home. Wayne Shutsky, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
You can find all of the KJZZ election reporting and the very useful voter guide at voterguide.kjzz.org. In health news, early voting begins next week, and in this election, Arizonans will decide on a ballot measure that would allow abortions up to the point of fetal viability, with some exceptions beyond that. But it's not the first time a question about abortion laws has appeared on the ballots in the state. Catherine Davis Young takes us back to 1992.
Nearly 20 years after the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision, abortion was back in the spotlight in 1992 because of another Supreme Court case. Pennsylvania had enacted some abortion restrictions, including a 24-hour waiting period and a parental consent rule, and abortion providers had sued.
People thought back in 1992 that this was going to be the case that overruled Roe v. Wade.
Barbara Atwood is professor of law emerita at the University of Arizona. She says as this case was pending, anti-abortion groups in Arizona turned their focus to the upcoming election. They launched a petition for a ballot measure to outlaw abortion in the state, except to save a mother's life, with possible exceptions in cases of rape or incest. Trent Franks, who would go on to represent Arizona in Congress for more than a decade, directed the campaign.
The premise of the initiative there was that if we didn't do it, the other side would.
Franks built his political career around his anti-abortion views before resigning from Congress in 2017 amid allegations of sexual harassment. Back in 1992, he really hoped to see Roe v. Wade fall, but the court delivered a more complicated decision.
Good evening. Abortion remains a constitutional right in America tonight, but a right that can be restricted. And everyone now is trying to determine what today's Supreme Court decision means for the future.
In a 5-4 vote, justices upheld most of Roe v. Wade, but left the door open for states to adopt Pennsylvania-style laws. 2 days after that ruling, Franks' campaign turned in more than 200,000 signatures to get their measure onto ballots. But since Roe v. Wade hadn't been overturned, the proposed near-total abortion ban was at odds with U.S. law, Atwood says.
There definitely would have been legal challenges.
Even the 1992 voter pamphlet cautioned the Supreme Court may have to weigh in if the measure passed. But Franks says that was the point. Supporters hoped to reshape abortion laws nationwide through the court cases they knew would follow Prop 110.
I mean, we were trying to force the court to do what they should have done.
The campaign, organized largely among evangelical church groups, outraised its opposition 2-1. But the opposition, Pro-Choice Arizona, had broad reach. Bree Thomas now heads the reproductive health nonprofit Affirm, but in 1992, she was a volunteer organizer for that campaign.
I remember there being quite a few Republicans and Democrats.
Arizona was a more deeply red state in 1992, but Thomas says this was the era of Barry Goldwater conservatism. The longtime senator was one of several influential Arizona Republicans to come out against Prop 110. He discussed his views with ABC's 2020.
I think it's a woman's right to determine whether or not she wants to have that child.
Thomas says that was a big difference 3 decades ago.
I don't remember it being as much as of a political party line divide at all.
On Election Day, Arizonans picked Republican George Bush for president, while most states picked Democrat Bill Clinton. Arizonans also gave more power to Republicans in state races. But these same voters rejected Prop 110 in a landslide. 68% voted no.
That's 60 points you have lost horribly, and it begs the question of what did you miss going in?
Kevin DeMena is a longtime Republican strategist. He didn't work on Prop 110, but thinks backers misjudged how Arizonans at the time would react to proposed abortion restrictions.
It was tone deaf for the moment.
32 years later, has the moment changed? Franks sees similarities to 1992. He thinks voters would have supported Prop 110 if it had been described as protecting unborn children, but the ballot defined it as prohibiting abortion. He thinks news coverage of this year's measure also frames the issue in terms that favor the other side.
The way it was distorted, just as this one is distorted, the pro-life cause is at great disadvantage.
Looking back on 1992, Bree Thomas sees parallels too, especially when it comes to voter sentiment.
People are done having politicians make these decisions for them. And I think, in a sense, that's exactly what was happening back in 92.
Thomas says political parties have become much more divided on abortion, but she thinks a lot of voters this year probably feel like those voters 32 years ago. Catherine Davis Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. Every Wednesday, KJZZ offers up hotspots to spice up your weekend. It's delivered right to your phone. Try something new or step out of the routine. Just visit hotspots.kjzz.org to sign up. In aging news.
80% of Americans ages 60 and older are facing an uncertain future. This population has too few resources to pay for long-term care or even basic things like food or transportation. That's according to an updated analysis by two national aging organizations. Kathy Ritchie has more.
The National Council on Aging and the Leading Age Long-Term Services and Support Center at UMass Boston released their updated analysis of a study that looked at the financial state of older Americans. And it's not good. Roughly 27 million households with adults ages 60 and older cannot afford basic living needs, things like food or health care. One reason why could be the lack of awareness about what it costs to age well.
That, I think, is the big issue in terms of education. And so if people kind of operate from the assumption that, oh, my Medicare will take care of this, then they might not make certain plans. They might not save for long-term care.
Lauren Marinero is a partner at an elder and disability law firm in New Jersey and sits on the board of the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys.
And look, no old person is like, yeah, I'm going to a nursing home. Like, nobody is planning for that because nobody thinks that they're ever going to get that sick.
Until they do. And statistically speaking, they likely will. A person turning 65 today has a nearly 70% chance of needing long-term care at some point. But even those who plan and do everything right are not necessarily protected. Many Americans will experience what's called a negative wealth shock, meaning they'll lose a significant portion of their net worth. Cheryl Kimi is the executive director for Neighbors Who Care in Sun Lakes. Her nonprofit helps seniors stay in their homes.
I will say that how our ratios look are a little skewed because most of our service area is a retirement community. So these are people who have prepared for retirement in an active resort type environment.
So they have more wealth than the general population of seniors.
However, even though folks do prepare, unexpected health issues that they have not prepared for when they crop up push them into a new category of needing assistance,
which they might not be able to afford. So they rely on volunteer programs like Neighbors Who Care to help fill the gap. The challenge, Kimi says, for this segment of the population is that there's only so much a volunteer can do.
Because we don't do anything medical, it becomes difficult for us because then we don't really have anything to refer them to.
Other than Arizona's long-term care system, or ALTEX, which covers the cost of long-term care services, including home health and nursing home care. But for many families who have assets, but not nearly enough to pay the thousands of dollars a month it costs for that kind of care, ALTEX isn't an option.
So then they're encouraged to spend down their assets in order to be able to qualify for this. And then they're left with nothing.
And if there's a healthy, surviving spouse, they're also left without much. Justin McBride is a senior director of services and strategy at Duet Partners in Healthy Aging, which serves homebound seniors.
And the vast majority of Arizonans, we've heard, would prefer to age in place in their own home.
But according to the report, that wish is out of reach for most older adults. McBride says about 85% of the seniors they serve have incomes under $2,800 a month. But just because they might meet the income eligibility criteria of ALTEX doesn't mean they'll meet the medical criteria. And ALTEX is incredibly difficult to acquire, even when both criteria are met. So they call organizations like Duet, who, like Neighbors Who Care in the East Valley, rely on an army of volunteers to help with doctor's visits, food shopping, and other chores around the house. But like any nonprofit doing the heavy lifting, resources, especially human ones, are limited.
We are limited by the number of volunteers that we have. We're limited by the amount of generous contributions that we have coming in. And it's through the community stepping up to serve, whether it's serving your neighbor directly or coming to somebody like Duet.
But even McBride acknowledges that the kindness of strangers is not enough to support the state's increasingly aging population. He says that by 2050, around a quarter of Arizonans will be 65 and older. And that includes members of Generation X, the eldest of whom are turning 60, starting next year. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In Fronteras News. More than 2 years after a devastating wildfire that scorched much of the eastern flanks of the San Francisco Peaks, officials say they've nearly completed a massive flooding prevention project that will end up costing more than $100 million. Michelle Marisco reports.
When the pipeline fire in the summer of 2022 roared across the peaks, it burned 27,000 acres that had already burned just a dozen years before in the Schultz fire. What followed was nearly 50 floods in a turbulent monsoon season that damaged homes, destroyed roads, and put some 1,500 houses and more than $1 billion in ranching property real estate under years of threat.
That's the saw. That's the saw that's engaging the pipe and cutting it.
Chris Duza is with Civil Tech Engineering. The firm is contracted with Coconino County to create ways to safely return these ranch lands into usable country. In this case, the firm has set up a pipe-making operation that turns tightly coiled loops of metal into giant 10-foot diameter pipes.
If we were to truck this out of the valley from El Mirage or Albuquerque, two pieces of pipe per flatbed, 4,000, 4,500 linear feet of pipe. It's a lot of truckloads coming up I-17, so it saves a whole lot of money.
The pipeline fire ruined 9 watersheds, those natural fans of soil, rock, and plant life that form on the mountain slopes and slow the water down. These pipes are being used as conduits for underground storm drains. Man-made sills of rocks had to be pounded into the ground where those fans once stood. And then the monsoon waters flow into giant channels and ultimately are piped out of the area into natural water channels like the Rio de Flag. So yes, a lot of pipe and rock and funding. Coconino County's Flood Control District is spending about $8 million in local money. The Forest Service and the Natural Resources Conservation Service are providing another $124 million in grants for these restorations. NRCS Chief Terry Cosby.
I think that what happens here is as you look at all the resources that we're dealing with, when you look at plants, soil, water, you know, animals, and you know, the human part of it is the most important aspect. And so how do we do this in a way that we're minimal impact on all those things, but also being able to have folks that live on the landscape. And a lot of that is through proper planning.
He said this investment equates to pre-work for future wildfire threats. When fires hit the ponderosas of the Coconino National Forest, they can turn explosive quickly. The tunnel fire in early 2022 raced on 50-mile-an-hour winds into 32 homes. The pipeline fire 2 months later sparked to life after a camper burned his used toilet paper in the forest during a fire ban. So the possibility feels more like an inevitability. Flagstaff Mayor Becky Daggett.
Well, the plan is to, with all of the mitigation that's going on upstream as well as closer into town, is that we're doing the treatment and the mitigation necessary so that it can withstand additional post-wildfire flooding. And so we've got a look on all of the watersheds and making sure that we've got mitigation in place to keep from flooding.
Coconino County Supervisor Patrice Horseman welcomes the work done, but warns that ultimately forest restoration is needed.
That's going to be the key to getting us out of this catastrophic wildfire, post-wildfire flooding scenario.
This project with the massive pipes and sills and millions of dollars to hold back the mountain, she calls government at its best.
This is what government is supposed to do. It's supposed to be there for people. It's supposed to help protect and to deal with some of the safety concerns we have.
Michelle Marisco, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. In education news, the Arizona Department of Administration has approved a waiver request to allow $15 million in funding to be used for school safety personnel. From the Education Desk, Bridget Dowd has details.
Late last week, the Department of Education identified $15 million in leftover funds that could be used to pay for extra officers through the school safety program. It then asked the state DOA to waive a portion of state law that requires at least 6 weeks of public notice for grant application requests. Now that the waiver has been approved, schools can apply for funding for armed officers, school counselors, and social workers. Superintendent of Public Instruction Tom Horn says they saw an uptick in school threats over a span of 20 days in September.
There have been 130 school threats. 80 of them have been shooting threats or weapons in the school. That is really scary. I mean, if you have that quantity of those kind of threats, sooner or later something bad's going to happen.
Those numbers come from the Arizona Counterterrorism Information Center. Bridget Dowd, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And now from KJZZ's original production. Endorsements from local fire or police can make or break a campaign, especially for a local candidate. What goes into getting an endorsement and what happens when you don't? Here's the show co-host Lauren Gilger with the answer.
Drive around town right now and you'll see campaign signs everywhere. And a whole lot of them seem to say endorsed by fire or endorsed by police, sometimes from candidates running against each other in the same race. Go on a candidate's website and you'll see their endorsements listed, from educators to the ACLU to the Free Enterprise Club. It made national headlines recently when Democrat Ruben Gallego won the endorsement of the Arizona Police Association over Republican Kerry Lake. But how much do these endorsements matter to voters, and how do candidates go about getting them? Well, my next guest has a lot of experience in that area. Paul Boyer spent 10 years in the state legislature, both in the House and the Senate. He's a conservative Republican known for sometimes bucking his party. And as he told me recently, sometimes bucking the wishes of his endorsers as well. We sat down in our studios recently to talk about it all. Here's our conversation.
Well, I mean, when I first ran, I was a nobody. I mean, nobody knew who I was, first time running. So I just knocked on as many doors as I could, and I made as many phone calls as I could. And for our conversation today, I got as many endorsements as I could.
Right. Okay. So endorsements are in the mix there. Where do endorsements fall? Like, how important are they, especially to a new candidate and especially at the local level?
Well, I think when there is a divided electorate, so I was in not a 50-50 district, but it was competitive. And so if you're running in an open seat and you get an endorsement, I really think that goes a long way, as opposed to, say, you get an endorsement and you're running against the incumbent. It's still going to be challenging just by nature of running against an incumbent.
Yeah. So I want to know, as a candidate, the first time around, but then also in subsequent elections, like, how do you go about getting endorsements? Like, who do you meet with? Who do you have to shake hands with? What's the process like? Is this about making promises? Is this about, you know, sitting down and saying, this is what I stand for? Is this about getting to know the right people?
Yeah. So what happens is, once you file and then once you qualify, once you turn in the minimum number of signatures that are verified, then typically you get questionnaires from all these different organizations, associations, and you fill it out, you turn it in, and then they usually reach out to you and say, hey, we'd like you to meet with our board so we can interview. We're interviewing all the candidates to see who we're going to endorse.
Interesting.
Now, when it comes to private individuals or just you know, like maybe former Senator Kyle, like, I reached out to him because I really wanted his endorsement, just because I admire the heck out of him. And I think that his name still carries a lot of weight in Republican primaries.
Interesting. So you did seek some out, but others you just have to pass some kind of litmus test.
Exactly. I mean, basically, the long and the short of it is you fill out every questionnaire that comes your way.
Okay. I mean, how did you approach that as a candidate? Like, did it feel like you needed to say certain things to certain organizations, or were you saying, well, here's where I stand and maybe we meet and maybe we don't?
Yeah. I mean, I pulled the old Martin Luther, here I stand, I cannot do otherwise, where I just said, this is who I am. If you want to endorse me, great. If not, then I get it. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. What endorsements mattered most?
For me personally, any police endorsement that I got, so whether it was the Arizona Police Association, the Phoenix Law Enforcement Association, there's a lot of them, the Fraternal Order of Police, and of course, fire really meant a lot to me too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There's an interesting difference there between police and fire, and those are kind of the two major players you'll see on people's campaign signs, like endorsed by fire, endorsed by police, whatever that may mean, as you said, because there are multiple associations within that. But talk a little bit about the differences between the police endorsement and the fire endorsement. They tend to be different ideologically as well.
Yeah, that's right. So I've talked to both organizations, and just because I've developed relationships with both of them, that you're going to benefit yourselves by being bipartisan. Now, to the police's credit, I think they're actively looking for anybody on the left that would support them at the legislature. They just have a really hard time finding somebody who could support them. And so they have to justify to their membership why they endorsed, you know, candidate so-and-so.
Mm-hmm.
They've typically endorsed Republicans primarily because Republicans are the ones who defend them at the legislature. Now, fire, they've taken a different approach where, I mean, they will endorse Republicans, but that's typically in an uncontested race.
Hmm.
But when it comes down to it, FIRE, if it's competitive, they'll typically, they lean left and they will endorse folks on the left.
How'd you get both?
Well, I think they knew that I was with them no matter what. I have a good friend who's a firefighter at a Goodyear, and he got me wrangled into a firefighter fitness course at Glendale Community College. And it was the hardest A I've had ever earned. But I got some insight into FIRE. I mean, that was just a fitness class. It wasn't even like the academy or anything that firefighters have to deal with. But I had more insight than my colleagues did, where I was willing to support FIRE regardless of what they did.
So how much does it matter when you do not get an endorsement like that, right? Like, and you have some personal experience here in your latest campaign for Glendale Mayor, right? Like, you failed to gather enough signatures, didn't end up on the ballot, and that had to do with endorsements from FIRE, it sounds like.
Well, that was more personal. Over the last 7 years, I had been not only running legislation for FIRE, but I had been going to war for them at the state legislature, even making enemies within my own party, even losing personal friendships over getting the sales tax referral, the tenth of a penny sales tax for FIRE districts. I really alienated a lot of my colleagues. So for me, it was personal because, I mean, anybody that's willing to take a bullet for you or to run into a burning building to save your life or a perfect stranger, to me, that's noble, it's noteworthy, and we should protect them regardless of what they did to me. But when they didn't endorse me for my run for mayor, it was really a kick in the gut. It really deflated my sales, where I just wasn't that interested in knocking on doors, because I thought, well, what's the point if my own friends are actively working against me? Yeah, I didn't know that I wanted to run for mayor at that point.
What are the political ramifications of that? Like, do voters care who's endorsed by FIRE or who's endorsed by police? How big of a difference can it make?
Well, I mean, outside of my own experience, I don't know that FIRE matters as much these days as police does in a Republican primary.
Interesting.
And let me illustrate. So Justine Wadsack, who I've never met, she ran against Vince Leach. And this last time she ran, she was in her Tesla going twice the speed limit, and she got rightly pulled over, and she tried to politicize it, saying, oh, they're going after me, it's political. Well, you don't go after the police as a Republican in a Republican primary. That's something, I won't say sacred, but that's something that's off limits.
So especially in a Republican primary, and especially when it comes to those police endorsements, it sounds like they can be very influential.
Yes, absolutely.
So I want to ask about the kind of the other side of this equation, right? So you're running a campaign, you get certain endorsements, then you maybe win, you go on to be in public office. Are there things that you're expected to do, or, you know, ways in which this has to pay off for those people who gave you those endorsements?
Yeah, I think there is an expectation.
Right.
Now, I've always told lobbyists and I've always told organizations, if you don't like the way I vote, then don't support me next time.
Mm. But you're going to have to keep answering those questions from those players as you're in office.
Well, let me give an example. So the Free Enterprise Club, they were 100% behind moving energy policy from the Corporation Commission, and they wanted to put it in the hands of the legislature. I thought it was a terrible idea. The legislature doesn't meet year-round. We don't have attorneys that deal specifically with energy policy. We don't have the judges that oversee these great cases. But the point is, there was an expectation that I should have supported that.
Hmm. And so that has repercussions for you politically.
It would have if I had run again, I'm sure. They
That's
would have been supported the other guy.
All right. We will leave it there for now. Paul Boyer, former state legislator and teacher, joining us to talk about endorsements. Paul, thank you so much for coming in. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
We also reached out to the professional firefighters of Arizona that Boyer talked about here. They told us, quote, this was not personal. They said, while they deeply appreciate Boyer's support as a legislator, his positions on Glendale issues, as well as Mayor Jerry Wire's work in support of Glendale firefighters, led them to go in a different direction in that race.
And finally, in business news. Fender Musical Instruments is starting construction on its new co-headquarters in Phoenix. As Christina Estes reports from the business desk, the iconic guitar maker plays a key role in the redevelopment of the former Paradise Valley Mall, now called PV.
During a groundbreaking ceremony, Fender CEO Andy Mooney praised PV's central location near Cactus Road and Tatum Boulevard. The three-story building is expected to open next fall.
Some of the custom aspects it will have will be a music studio, a boom room where you can test amplifiers to destruction, We'll have a cafe for the employees. We will have an outdoor deck on the roof where we can hold concerts.
Fenders is part of Red Development's 100-acre project,
which is the same size as what downtown Phoenix is.
Red's Jeff Malozniak says a Whole Foods will open next month. Right above the store are 400 apartments scheduled to open in November.
And when it's fully built out by the end of this decade, you know, there'll be over 2,000 residents just living inside those boundaries.
Housing, retail, and working spaces will be linked by a 3.5-acre park located in the center of the project. Christina Estes, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And this has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. It's made possible in part by Helios Education Foundation and Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation and Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.